Friday, January the 10th, was one of the great days in the White House. It began early, breakfast at 8, and then desk work, and then to the swimming pool. How I have loved and used this place. And then Mr. Pears for a shampoo and set. Desk work these days is heavily sprinkled with pictures for autographing. Because the end of our administration is near at hand, people in the government, people in the White House, old friends far and wide, are sending in a picture they've long had to be autographed, or asking for one. Always before me is the memory of Lyndon's long and rather close association with President Roosevelt and the very few that we had at the end of the 8 years he'd known him. And so I am glad to. At 1 o'clock, there was a luncheon that Bess had suggested. Mr. Holding, the president of Tiffany's, who had fought the Battle of the White House China with us, was coming for a quiet lunch with me, and of course I had insisted Bess come too. He had been the real general. Our enemy had been trying to turn an idea of mine into an elegant reality worthy of the White House and of Tiffany's, and I hoped, of the Johnson administration. It turned out to be a formidable enemy. All of the service, save only the dessert plates, had made a well-acclaimed, highly satisfactory debut last May and had taken their place on the table for White House dinners and in the China Room, along with Monroe's and Lincoln's and Wilson's. The dessert plates remained a sticky problem that we hoped didn't come out in somebody's column while we worked earnestly how to solve it. The upshot was that every piece had to be hand-painted, and that, in the 1960s, is a very slow and expensive process. Tiffany's, on the contract price, was going to lose considerable money. Bess had ably, gently, toughly, in her most ladylike manner, upheld the White House side of getting them done beautifully. How glad I am she was dealing for me. I never could have done it. And Mr. Holding had come through in a completely gentlemanly, perhaps privately rueful fashion. Yes, Tiffany's would see that they were hand-painted, an approved design, and carried to an elegant completion. So I went in to meet Mr. Holding, an attitude composed of apology, gratitude, and keen interest because of all the things I had heard about him. He proved to be a delightful luncheon companion. That tread-worn phrase, man of the world, fitted him most aptly. He talked about the process of Vermeil, or rather, he talked, and he told us how in the days of the French king, Louis XIV and XV, it had been made by using mercury, I think it was. And after many painstaking years, the workman would go blind. And then he described the new process and how it had become the very popular thing of today. He spoke casually, authoritatively, of other administrations, whole decades of them. Obviously, he was a very strong Republican. I think we had between the three of us a sense of smirking satisfaction that the difficulties of the dessert plates had been a well-kept secret for 8 months in this town that loves such tidbits, and it will be months before the plates are finally here, if ever. Our lunch was in the Lincoln sitting room, table spread by the window facing the monuments, and we used china from various administrations. A small, pleasant conversation piece for such knowledgeable people as Mr. Holding. And then, in the middle afternoon, there were two other bits of goodbye business. First, down to the state dining room for a picture with the tour office, Bruce Thomas, Joe Bruno, and all the tour officers and White House police who have escorted through this great house at times of ordinary duty and probably at times of outrageous inconvenience to them, besides the never-ending general public. My own groups of friends from home or friends from the campaign trail or from my trips, or my Alabama cousins, all the stream of house guests. We stood in a half moon, and Bob Knudsen was the choreographer, and he snapped picture after picture, and someday I will autograph them with warmest appreciation to people who have given happiness and exciting memories to so many in this house. And then, next, I went back up to the yellow oval room for tea with a group of independent agency wives, about 8 ladies. Vinnie Deason was the only one I knew well, who were bringing to me a little piece of petty point, a presentation from their organization, a charming goodbye gift. We spent about 30 lively minutes together, And then I worked briefly at my desk with Carol Carlisle on tonight's dinner, our goodbye to our official family, the Cabinet. Then recorded and then talked to Harry Middleton about our film project. And then around 4 o'clock, into the Lincoln bedroom for a 2-hour sitting with Robert Burks, the sculptor, who is doing my head. Took a batch of mail in and signed it and worked with Bess on Lith and the last parties. It's been a thoroughly interesting experience getting to know Mr. Burks and his wife. He is a tall, craggy-looking man with bright, warm eyes and a beard chopped off square at the end that somehow reminds me of Hammurabi. They're both on very good terms with life. He loves his house on the tip end of Long Island, an extraordinary rural-sounding place within just a few miles of New York City. And he had interesting little bits to say about the people whose heads he'd done, David Dubinsky and Einstein and Bob Kennedy, whom he said he saw as a wounded eagle, and his head will be dedicated in the courtyard of the Justice Department in just a few days. He's really seen our family under all sorts of circumstances. He's done 2 heads of Lyndon, whose settings were in the West Hall, which is so much like Union Station, that I withdrew to the Lincoln Room. And at my last sitting, Lindbergh came in and demanded my attention about how to go about buying or renting a house. She had just had the news that Chuck would be stationed here. I am delighted. And she must begin to think about it, though she couldn't do anything final until Chuck is back and sees houses. And Lucy came in for the full description of her plans to go and see Patrick in Formosa and of all the shots that she's getting in preparation, cholera and so forth. They are no more inhibited in front of strangers than 2 kittens. But they too, I feel, liked both Mr. and Mrs. Burks. He left shortly after 6, and I went in and fell gratefully on the bed and made a series of calls to Dr. Hurst, who is a house guest here for the last time, and Joe Mashman, who's here with his wife and daughter, to welcome them and suggest things that they might want to do on their sightseeing trip, and then a little desk work with Ashton and Bess. It was a symptom of busy days at the White House, doing 2 things at once, that is, lying down to rest while I keep busily phoning or signing mail or going over seating charts or guest lists. What a gloriously busy time it's been. And then Mr. Pear for a hair comb. And then into my pink gold dress from Thailand. And it was time for our dinner for the Cabinet. I was there early and eager. I love them. And they were there, every one of them. And Hubert and Muriel, in whose honor the dinner was being given. For me, it was an evening highly charged with emotion, with the desire to drink it all in, to remember it all, with a feeling of the specialness of every guest. There were Dean and Virginia Russ, and Clark and Marnie, and Georgia and Ramsey, Marvin and Marion, looking more beautiful all the time, and Stu and Lee. I told him I wanted to get together with him and talk about the advisory committee for the national parks and get some briefing on it. Orville and Jane and C.R. and Bill and Jane Wirtz and Wilbur and Eloise Cohen, our bridge playing friends, the Allen Boyds. Bob Weaver, without Ella, who has been absent from all parties for weeks with an operation, I think. And my all-time favorites, Henry and Trudy Fowler, who slipped into private life just a few days before Christmas. Gratefully, their surcease well-deserved, and there were their replacements, Joe Bars and the Bob Woods, who'd taken over HUD. Linda and Lucy feel very close to our Cabinet. It meant a great deal to me to have them present, and Lucinda came in, dressed in her Petunia Pig outfit, some Dior pink knit tights, riding in her baby buggy or on her mother's shoulder, surveying everybody with her big solemn eyes. Patrick Lyndon bounced in and out between everybody's feet, a menace to the hors d'oeuvres and the ashtrays and any drinks that were momentarily deposited, always close to his grandfather. I had put our 2 portraits out at the end of the hall. Most of the Cabinet have seen them, but not all, and they drifted down to look and came back with their various appraisals. It seems to me that perceptibly Dean Rusk gets cheerier, his mood lighter, and his smile broader as the days go by.
They had a delicious dinner, Chateaubriand Béarnaise, and ending with Soufflé Grand Marnier, and I was touched that Dean seemed as pleased as a little boy. How did you know that was my favorite dessert? I do not put it past Bess for knowing. Dinner became a very snowfall of menu cards being passed around the tables for autographs and even carried from one table to the other. Alas, my nerve failed after I had carried it to one table. The third I missed, but it is one of my most precious possessions. These dear names on the stiff white card with the gold borders and the seal embossed at the top. Everyone was talking of their plans, of where they would live next, a vacation trip in between, and Jane Freeman of getting everyone's address so she could bring us all together, no pun intended, when some of us were back in town. Before dinner, all the ladies had lined up on the yellow sofa and the surrounding chairs, our backs to the great monuments. Bob Knudsen had taken our pictures over and over because few that I will take away will be this precious. Lyndon and all the men had gone to the tree room, from which the ponderous red Victorian sofa had been removed. They had all lined up underneath Lincoln's Search for Peace, and there had had the last cabinet picture made. At the end of dinner, Lyndon made the first toast to Hubert, to Dean, to all the cabinet, and then Dean responded. What a marvelous, eloquent flow of English he always has, and yet so simple. I know when Lyndon talks of Dean and his work, his voice shifts into a deeper gear of admiration and enthusiasm. I think it is not too much to think, I believe, that there is something of the same in Dean's response to Lyndon. And then Hubert spoke, cheerful, even exuberant. He was not cast for the role of tragedy. I could not find myself feeling really sorry for him, even within a week after the election. I looked so ready as he to embrace life. I looked at Linda and Lucy. I felt that Linda was just holding back tears. There are very few times when I want to speak, and this was one. I used Dickens' words, I think they are. It was the worst of times. It was the best of times, and spoke of the comradeship forged from working together on tremendously important problems and feeling you've made some progress. It's a rare, unequaled feeling, a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and we are fortunate to have known it, to have shared it with you, and we're grateful. I looked around the room and locked eyes here and there with some that I felt closest to, and one or two that I had not always felt closest to and nevertheless admired tremendously, and for once felt that I was speaking well, and their response told me so. But no, I was topped. Lucy, in her tentative little girl way, asked if she could make a toast. A charming, but I think it masked complete self-assurance. She spoke with freshness and truth. She said, "You have been working so hard, but it's for people like me and Linda, and even more for Lynn and Lucinda, who will reap the benefits of what you've done. So I want to say thank you for our generation and for those that are coming on." Everybody loved it. She was the star of the evening. And then the ladies went into the yellow room and had coffee, and the men stayed in the West Hall. And the evening came to an end a little before 12. For me, it had been a tender evening, every moment to be caught and remembered, separated from the stream of time by its remarkable uniqueness. And I think every one of us must have looked over our shoulder for a parting glimpse of the Jefferson Memorial as we walked out of the yellow room. But I had given a thought to the future, too, and had mentioned quite a lot of the ladies over coffee that I hoped as they went through their papers, they would keep in mind that the Lyndon Johnson Library wanted to invite the ladies of the cabinet, as well as their husbands, to deposit their papers in the library. There are so many of these women who have themselves pursued some vigorous program connected with this administration's work. Jane Wirtz, in trying to get work for the disabled and market their goods. Lee Udall, in showing the work of Indian craftsmen to the nation and trying to create more of a market for them. Margie McNamara in her time, in trying to get books into the hands of children in the ghettos. I want to make sure their contributions become a part of the whole story.
And so we hug the last goodbyes at the elevator.
The red-coated Marine bandsman folded up the instruments. The queenly yellow oval room settled into quiet. Our farewell dinner for the cabinet slipped into memory.